Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Welcome back to the Munganass St. Louis Honda Sports Open Line.
Munganass St. Louis Honda on South Lindbergh.
On America's Sports Voice, KMOX.
This is Inside Cardinals Nation on KMOX and the Cardinals Radio Network, presented by White Castle. You know what's clutch? White Castle after a day at the ballpark. My guest this hour will be Derek Gould of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, who covers the Cardinals day in and day out, also noted author. A book that came out a few years ago called 100 Things Cardinal Fans Should Know and Do Before They Die. The forward then was by Stan the Man. The book has been updated with a forward from Adam Wainwright. And Derek Gould is my guest. I'm Dan McLaughlin of Fox Sports Midwest. I have read, Derek, a number of these books, and I understand that the book in the series that came out, a lot of the beat writers were asked to do the books for their particular series, and I'm going to give you a lot of credit. I've read all of them, and some of them were like, hey, make sure you go get a hot dog at this hot dog stand. You didn't do it that way. You did it with a lot of research and putting a lot of effort and time into trying to figure out some of the unique aspects of the history of this club.
It was the first time that I was kind of given the wheel to a book. I'd been a part of or written other books that were kind of governed by editors or sort of targeted on one specific topic, like a while back wrote on some college football stuff and everything like that. But here was someone handing me the wheel to a book with somewhat of a general guideline. There had been some brief history. There had been one of these 100 things done before, and they wanted to branch out into a whole, you know, all 30 teams, all football teams, all that stuff. And they were trying to figure out how to do that. So they gave me the one that had been done. And then the late Nick Cafardo, longtime Boston Globe baseball writer, he and I were working on sort of the next step in that group. So there really wasn't a roadmap at all for how to handle it. And we were given a chance to kind of make it our own. And I went in thinking, all right, well, what can I write that is revelatory about Cardinal history? What can I point people towards that, you know, that maybe they don't know about the sort of Cardinal geography? And how do I mix those two things? And, you know, given the chance to kind of write the first book on my own, I wanted to see what I could do. It was a good challenge. Took me probably a little longer than the editors wanted, to be candid. It was rewarding too, because what it did is it allowed me to not just dip my toe into Cardinal history, but kind of wade in it and swim around in it and tread water in it and find new depths of it. And that's given me such an appreciation that has broadened and enriched my appreciation for the history, but also gave me a chance to tell maybe new tales that even the casual fan didn't know. And I'm told it's a good bathroom read.
Well, it's better than that. I'll tell you this. It was interesting. I'm sure you went back through the Post-Dispatch archives, mm-hmm. and maybe the Globe Democrat or yep. wherever you could find it. But then you did your due diligence then in reading those articles, and for those that were still alive to tell the tales, to yeah. reconfirm them and maybe add to them.
Yeah, yeah. One of the things that you talk about, like when you do a book, is secondary and primary reporting. Secondary is like you're talking about getting from magazines, getting from websites, getting from archives. And then primary is where you are directly involved in the interview process. There were some things that had been repeated so often that they became lore or became fact, and I wanted to track those down.
Which ones came to mind when you think about, well, that was said a lot probably on the broadcast, old Danny Mac just spewing lies. Which ones came to fruition that you thought were, you know, ones that you really wanted to follow up on?
One of the stories that I heard a lot about was Enos Slaughter, and obviously it was well told how often, you know, or how emotional he was when he was traded from the Cardinals to the Yankees and how much the Cardinals meant to him. But it was often said that, you know, that he was so profoundly fond of being a Cardinal That he was buried in his Cardinal jersey or with his Cardinal rings. And
I told that story, by the way, at Wrigley Field to Tim McCarver, and he was floored. But go ahead.
Yeah. So it, and you know, I mean, it swirled around so much so that it, like I said, it became kind of an urban legend.
Right.
Is it actually true? Is that actually what happened? And in doing this book, it was like, all right, well, here's a chance to set out and try to find out that answer and find somebody who knows for sure whether it's true and then tell the backstory of it. And it took a while, you know, it took a while to kind of pull the thread and to find the right people and to exchange emails with the right members of the family and then uncover maybe some details that people had hoped would be private. You know, and you're asking like an uncomfortable question, but I felt like it's been told so many times that, you know, finding the truth of it would be good.
And the answer is?
He is.
That's right.
You know, and in the book, it tells not only that he is, but who supplied the jersey and what kind of jersey it is.
In trying to come up with 100 of these, and you probably could have done 1,000 of them, you know, 1,000 things at least that Cardinal fans should know and do before they die. How did you break it down to 100?
Well, you know, one of the things is, was it's things to know, fans should know and do. So I had to really make it, pay attention to what should they do. I could write 100 things that they should know, and you could write 100 anecdotes plucked from, you know, more than a century of history and say, here's the guy who hit this, or here's the game that did this, or here's the seat cushions that were thrown here, or here's the home, you know, that was stolen by Glenn Brummer there. But I also had to fix in some do's. And so I tried to make sure that as many things as I put in there from history, that I tried to lace in things that they could actually do and maybe tie those to history as well. I also wanted to sort of explore, you know, some maybe uncelebrated moments in history, or at least moments that maybe should get more attention, like Cy Young throwing the first pitch for the Perfectos. You know, opening day Cy Young is, I mean, you could argue that Cardinal history began with a pitch by Cy Young.
That's right.
And I wanted to make that case in the book. So I wanted to do things like that. And you're right. I mean, finding that balance, I'm sure I could write the book 100 times and come up with 100 different ways. I will say that there's like little Easter eggs in there for why the numbers of, like, every chapter has a number right at 1 through 100. And there are little Easter eggs for, you know, each one as to why that number gets that topic, or why that chapter is that topic. You know, some of them are obvious, like the World Series years. Some of them are a little bit, you know, more like insider, kind of a wink. But I wanted to have fun with it, too.
I thought you did a great job with it. We'll take a quick timeout, then we'll get into some of these really unique stories. If you love Cardinals history, Derek Gould has the book out. It's been re-released. 100 Things Cardinals Fans Should Know and Do Before They Die. Back with more in just a moment.
Welcome back to the Munganass St. Louis Honda Sports Open Line.
Munganass St. Louis Honda on South Limburg.
On America's Sports Voice, KMOX.
100 Things Cardinals Fans Should Know and Do Before They Die. This is Inside Cardinals Nation on KMOX. And our chance to visit with Derek Gould, the author of this book. This, again, is presented by White Castle. You know what's clutch? White Castle, after a day at the ballpark. Inside Cardinals Nation will be coming to you all throughout the summer with various guests all concerning St. Louis Cardinals baseball. Interesting that Stan the Man wrote the foreword for your first book, and you got Adam Wainwright to do the foreword for this version that is now coming out. Tell me a little bit about Stan's foreword and about Adam's foreword.
So different, sir, different parts of the Cardinal history spectrum, right? When I first wrote the book, I thought, well, might as well kind of aim high, right, for the forward. I wrote to Stan and asked him if he would be interested in doing it, and worked with Stan's people to see if he would be interested in doing it. And to my surprise and to my, you know, eternal greatness and also just like very humbling, he said yes. And he wrote about it. He wrote about, you know, being a Cardinal Nation, and sort of the idea of what it meant to be defined by the Cardinals and to have a career entirely captured within being a Cardinal, and then a life after being a Cardinal in St. Louis. You know, Wainwright gave more of a modern twist to that, sort of his ties to the memories of the current era of Cardinals and what it meant to see the greatness of past teams and sort of history reflected in even the current era. Similar themes, but definitely, you know, Stan talking about life after the Cardinals and what it meant, and Wainwright talking about life with the Cardinals.
It's pretty great. I love in one of his speeches, and I put together, if you're ever calling the Cardinals and you're put on hold, you'll hear great highlights throughout the years. And one of the speeches and moments that I found from Stan was, and he's tearing up, crying, and he says to my mother and to the Cardinals, I'm paraphrasing, thank you for making me a Cardinal forever. And he's crying.
Yeah.
I get goosebumps thinking about that right now. The first one I want to stay on Stan is Meet Me at Mutual. And for generations of fans, Cardinal Nation is Walnut Street and Broadway. And then that's his statue. Here stands baseball's perfect warrior. Here stands baseball's perfect knight. And that was from Ford Frick when Mutual retired from the game. And there's still, I say it all the time on the telecast, we have a shot of that statue.
Mm-hmm.
I'll meet you at Mutual. There have been hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of fans that have said, I'll meet you at the Mutual statue.
So when I thought about, you asked about like kind of organizing the book or how I decided, I mean, first and foremost, I thought, all right, well, this has to not just be like a chronology of Cardinal history. And what I wanted to do was set up and sort of do a topography of Cardinal history, you know, sort of a map.
Yeah.
High points, low points, you know, memorable points, but points. And every journey with the Cardinals fan, every journey begins with Musial and meeting friends there. And that was something that I learned when I went to Mizzou and would come to St. Louis for a game. You know, one of the reasons why I was intrigued by going to Mizzou was because it was 126 miles either way to Major League Baseball, and I could get there, you know, quickly and see a game. That was something that I did not have the luxury of growing up. Until my senior year in high school, I could not just drive to a ball game, but I could do that from Mizzou. And if I met friends in St. Louis, or, you know, we were taking separate cars and we were going to meet at the ballpark, it was always meet at Musial at the
That's
plaza
right.
there. And, you know, when the book was first done and then subsequent editions like the new and expanded one, you know, it kind of offered a nice framework for let's begin where every fan usually begins his day at Musial, tell that story and sort of set a tone for, hey, look, we're going to walk a path together through Cardinal history, and then we'll end by going into the new ballpark. And that's how the book is set up.
Kind of unique here at number 32, talking about meeting places, because we see it all the time now at the new ballpark, is that if you have a private tour at the ballpark and you meet a certain front office member, they'll meet you and you'll walk underneath by the green seats. But one of the things that you may see is the wall that is Marty Hendon's
right.
Trinket City. And not many people know about this, but Marty Hendon was a VP in the late 1970s of the Cardinals, got his own office. And in that office, if you walked in, you would see all the bobbleheads and the giveaways and the pins and the pennants and the hats and the jerseys. Now it's almost every night at the ballpark. Back then, up until a few years ago, they were spaced out so during the season. So Marty had a few of those, and he would always bring them into his office. Also, Marty lined up many of the celebrities that would come down and sing, take me out to the ball game, throw out a first pitch, go meet the radio guys, go meet the TV guys. Trinket City is something mm-hmm. I hope that fans get a chance to look at and take in all the photos, because that's really cool, and I know you wrote about that.
Yeah, yeah. Trinket City was something that, so I'd heard about, you know, being at the old ballpark, you talk to Marty and you'd have a chance to see it. It was kind of the Smithsonian of Cardinal history,
sure
right?
Sure was.
I mean, you kind of, everything collected like you described, and you know, spent some time with Marty talking about it, how it came to be, what his prize collections were. This was before they set up the whole display there at Bush, was when we first were discussing it, and actually went out to his alma mater, UMSL, where they had part of the collection there at the Student Union. So students could walk by and see some of Trinket City. It was sort of a, let's say, a Trinket City annex, if you will. And Marty took me on a tour of it, you know, telling me what different parts meant to him, where he got different pieces of it, how something came to pass, what licensing was behind something. Real quick on Marty Hendon. I mean, he's a name that on the business side should probably resonate with the same volume that George Kissel does on the baseball side.
And Dan Farrell, for sure.
Dan Farrell. And yeah. I don't say that lightly.
I don't either.
In part because the opening day ceremony, as you know it, was a large part of brainchild of Marty Hendon.
That's right.
And so we all talk about how there's no opening day like Cardinal opening day. Well, there wasn't a Cardinal opening day before, you know, Marty Hendon said, let's find a way to celebrate this and make it stand apart.
I get asked all the time, where should I go when I go? And I'm going to keep on the theme of destinations here. Where should I go? What should I do down in spring training?
Yeah.
I love that you wrote about this. It's number 50, Roger Dean Stadium in Jupiter, Florida. Some of the things to do.
Book.
And
real quick, in the new book, it's not number 50. And you can guess why.
Why?
Because number 50 belongs to Adam Wainwright.
Yeah.
In the new expanded,
okay.
Wainwright gets his own chapter.
Okay.
In the new expanded.
In the old, I'm in going the old on the old book.
No, I know. Halfway through was the idea.
Yeah. And I think as we wrap up this segment, you know, visiting Roger Dean Stadium, I always tell fans, if you have the means to do it, go down to spring training, Roger Dean Stadium, you're up close. Pitchers fielding practice you write about.
Yeah.
Things have changed a little bit back there. You have the Land of Oz where you learn how to be a gold glover. You got different things that you can do, but it's really, I think you encapsulated it quite nicely.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that you and I get to see. It's also something that, you know, I talked at length with Tony La Russa. You know, shockingly, Dan, Tony La Russa has an opinion as to when the best time of spring training is.
Oh, I'm sure. And it is?
It's the bridge week, as we kind of came to call it.
Okay.
Which is that week where you have the final days where it's just workouts, and then the first days of games. And the idea is that, you know, you go in there to Florida and you have some days where it's just workouts early in the morning, go till 1-2 o'clock in the afternoon, but you get to see complete workouts and you're probably never going to get closer to the major league players, the major league team, or sort of the relaxed atmosphere of spring training than in those workouts. You're going to see the whole team out there at that time. And then you get to have your afternoons to yourself with beach, whatever, dinner, all that stuff. But then you reward yourself a few days later with the actual games, and games that, you know, you're going to see a lot of pitchers, you're going to see a lot of players. They all kind of cycle through those early games. And so Tony said that that's the best time because you get the full scope of spring training. His argument was too many people ignore the workouts and they just come for the games. And the workouts can be some of the most rewarding time because it allows for, and you've seen this, Dan, for fans to interact with the players.
Absolutely. Very quickly, about 1 minute in this segment, I said I was going to go, but I have to ask you about this. Visiting with Brian Finch in the Cardinals Hall of Fame and see the Cardinal treasures. That's number 10.
Yeah. I mean, look, they have a remarkable Hall of Fame.
Over 22,000 artifacts.
And all of Musial's.
Right.
He donated so much of his own collection.
Most of his, not all.
Not all, but most.
Yes.
To the Cardinals. Some very prominent pieces of his collection are now with the Cardinals. Cooperstown considers it the second best collection of baseball artifacts to the National Baseball Hall of Fame.
Make sure you do it. So the book again, 100 Things Cardinals Fans Should Know and Do Before They Die. Derek Gould is my guest. I'm Dan McLaughlin. Inside Cardinals Nation here on KMOX.
Welcome back to the Munganass St. Louis Honda Sports Open Line.
Munganass pre-owned on South Limburg.
On America's Sports Voice, KMOX.
Inside Cardinals Nation presented by White Castle. You know what's clutch? White Castle after a day at the ballpark. My guest for this show is Derek Gould, 100 Things Cardinals Fans Should Know and Do Before They Die. I want to get into some of the Hall of Famers that you wrote about, and I'm going to start with the late, great Red Schoendienst.
Yeah, so I'm lucky to have actually spent time with him, but we began by talking about some of the urban legends that grow up around the Cardinals. Certainly, Red has his share of them too, you know, the sleeping on the park bench during his tryout and everything. So I was able to sit at the new ballpark with him actually for quite a while. We just sat in the stands, I guess, during BP.
That's awesome.
And he told me the story, you know, sort of the Red origin story, and it was nice to revisit it. And then for the new edition to go back and realize that when I wrote it for the first time, I didn't do a good enough job of capturing how good a player he was. You know, I felt
like... It often
like,
gets overlooked.
Yeah, I felt like when I wrote it, I kind of catered to the whole, lifetime with the Cardinals and, roommate of Musial and, manager and everything like that. And I kind of, I hit all
and
the
a
right...
a fill-in for Stan at one point.
That's right. I hit all the notes. You know, I hit all the notes that you're supposed to. You know, I did my checklist. But I realized that, like, look, I need to do a better job of capturing what he was like as a player. What was the skills and what was the performances and what was the production and what was the career that got him elected to the Hall of Fame? And so in going back into this book and writing basically an in memoriam for him and updating what I was able to do that. I was able to expand the discussion of Red and take a deeper look at his playing career.
I thought it was amazing. The great quote, "We played mostly baseball as kids, a lot of ragball. And when we saw that ad, we thought, let's try it out," said Red Shandies. "I just wanted to see about it, see if I could play. I guess they saw something in me." And then Musial said, quote, "Besides Jackie Robinson, to your point, Derek, for 10 or 15 years there, Red was the best second baseman in the league." End quote. I had a night with Red, an evening with the Cardinals that I put on, and Red was there. And we got into when he was a young man, a wire staple in his left eye as a teenager, yeah. Had double vision, and then tuberculosis that he dealt with, which would sap his energy, could have had multiple batting titles. An amazing, amazing player.
Yeah, and even then, like when he returned from tuberculosis too, one of the more gifted second basemen, you know, that had people when he was with the Milwaukee Braves and helped put that together, kind of the glue that brought that team together and made it a championship contender. They were raved about how he played at that point in time. Just a savvy baseball player.
We're going to talk now about Lou Brock, and everybody knows the trade that brought Lou Brock to the Cardinals and the catalyst of 1964 and getting them to the World Series and winning it over the Yankees. But what did you find out about Lou that maybe you didn't know about Lou Brock?
I was really struck by the fact, I think it's a story that's been well told, but the way Lou tells it and trying to capture the tone in which he tells it about, you know, Johnny Keene, right, saying, look, you're going to steal. That's what you're here for. I'm recalling this right, like the meeting where they had, look, we need a guy like this and you're going to be that guy. And Lou trying to process this idea that, like, you know, and we see guys actually kind of, it's a story that tells itself over and over again, right? Even talking to Colton Wong somewhat this year, you hear echoes of it as well, where he's like, well, what kind of player can I be? Well, the game says hit for power. The game says do damage. The game says you'll get paid if you drive in all these runs. And here was this guy being told, look, you got to steal. Go out there and steal. And he's like, wait a minute. No, I want to hit home runs. I want to be that kind of ball player. I want to be the ball player that strikes fear in the opposing team. And the decision was like, okay, we can try to be that guy and not stick around. Or you can steal and have a long career. And, you know, Lou Brock ran his way all the way to the Hall of Fame. I like that story that you can see how baseball repeats itself in some ways, but also like the idea that Lou found a calling when he was told this is what you have to do. I think there's a quaintness to it, and he tells it so well. I'm failing in recounting it, but I wanted to write when I wrote it. I was like, all right, I need to try to capture the spirit in which, you know, Lou tells it, which is like a mix of bemusement, a mix of frustration, and then a mix of exhilaration. Finally, towards the end, it's like a little small three act play in the clubhouse.
Inside Cardinals Nation, my guest Derek Gould, 100 things Cardinals fans should know and do before they die. This segment, we're talking about some of the Cardinals Hall of Famers and unique stories with them. And I think about Bruce Sutter. There was a interesting quote that you had in this. He said the Hall of Fame, quote, brought closure to a baseball career that did not end how and when I had always hoped it would. I believe he retired, forced to retire in 1988 because of shoulder issues. Number 42, though, is retired. Quote, the call answered a question that had been ongoing for 13 years. A question, quite frankly, I would ask myself every year, do you belong? I find that really interesting into the man's soul a little bit, because when I talk to him, I hear that. But
yeah,
to me, his pitch redefined the game, and he was dominant. He had 300 saves, closed out a World Series, ironically enough, with a fastball against Gorman Thomas, yeah, not the split finger. But Bruce Sutter is such an interesting guy.
Yeah, really, and in that role, too. I mean, you're talking about the early days of sort of the monster closer, right? I mean, you know, helping to define, you know, in every way, like what Mariano Rivera is for the closers of today, Sutter was for the closers right before Mariano Rivera. I mean, a guy who had a pitch that was so good and so difficult to deal with and spread as people tried to duplicate it, tried to replicate it. So a lot like Rivera's cutter. And then in a role where, you know, you've worked with the Mad Hungarian, there's some theatrics to that role. There's some drama to the closer role. And for people of a certain age, ball players of a certain age, Sutter was the shutdown closer that defined it.
I find this very interesting with Tony La Russa, and I've told this now, he's a Hall of Famer, and we're talking about the Hall of Famers here. When Bob Gibson said to him as he won the 2006 World Series, "Welcome to the club," that solidified him as a Cardinal.
So that is a story, and I'm sure you were in the same spot as me, that I had been told by Tony multiple times before they won a World Series. This was definitely on his mind, that he was not quite a Cardinal until he had. He would talk about, "I have a ring, but not the ring. You need to be a Cardinal, you need to have the ring." You know, he would talk about how, you know, you had the guys like Gibson and you had the guys like Brock, and Musial was around, and they had the ring, the world championship ring. And then, you know, they win 2006, and he's walking into his room. And so it was like, it was an interesting thing, because you got to see the story play out in real time as it was on his mind in 04, as it was on his mind again in 05, as, you know, that 06 team kind of comes together and gels and then goes on to win, how he had resolution to it.
Absolutely. And again, my guest, Derek Gould, the book, 100 Things Cardinal Fans Should Know and Do Before They Die. And the final Hall of Famer I'll ask you about that's in the book, and these are all unique stories behind the names, is Ozzie Smith. And you mentioned all the Hall of Famers in here, but I'm just going through some of them. Ozzie.
And possibly future Hall of Famers.
That's right. Ozzie, inducted into the Hall of Fame in 2002, number retired in 1996. And known really as the greatest defensive shortstop of all time, 15-time All-Star, 13 Gold Gloves. And those were consecutive that he won. What stood out when you dug in on Ozzie Smith?
I think, you know, the origin story of, you know, his how he became such a gifted fielder, you know, gifted athlete, obviously, great eye-hand coordination, all that stuff, you know, and then the glove made out of a paper bag, and, you know, the games that he would play as a kid working on, or, you know, that created this great fielder, even though at the time he was just having fun, right? And then how the craftsman kind of took over, you know, the real merge of great skill and then great instinct and intellect that goes into that position. I thought those were the things that, you know, in talking to him and looking through his career, I thought that's what really stood out, is like, look, this is a guy who, you know, we talk about hitters and we talk about pitchers. We talk about the, you know, they take these raw skills and they add understanding, and that's when they're at their best. You know, you think about, like, oh, well, you know, Ted Williams obviously thought so much about hitting and was this master craftsman at the plate. And then you think about Greg Maddux and, oh, the professor on the mound, he's outsmarting people. We probably don't say that enough about defensive players, but we ought to about Ozzie Smith. Here was a guy who had, you know, gave a master's class in preparation to play defense, who gave a master's class in how to compensate maybe when he wasn't feeling all that great to still play great defense. Here was a guy who knew his home field and all of its hops better than, you know, some of us know our fingerprints. I was really struck by, like, we got to look at Ozzie Smith as a glove man in the same way that we look at Musial as a hitter, Williams as a hitter, you know, Maddux as a pitcher.
We're going to talk about some of the numbers that define the St. Louis Cardinals: Hornsby, Gibson, Carlton, and Brock. That's next. 100 Things Cardinal Fans Should Know and Do Before They Die, written by Derek Gould. We're back with more in a moment.
Welcome back to the Munganass St. Louis Honda Sports Open Line.
Munganass St. Louis Honda on South Lindbergh.
On America's Sports Voice, KMOX.
Inside Cardinals Nation is presented by White Castle. You know what's clutch? White Castle, after a day at the ballpark. And my guest is Derek Gould, 100 Things Cardinals Fans Should Know and Do Before They Die. Derek has written a follow-up to the original book, and now it includes some of the newer stories. But if you love Cardinals history, it truly is a walk down memory lane. We've talked about the Hall of Famers, destination spots, and now some of the numbers that define the St. Louis Cardinals. And I'm going to go with Rogers Hornsby and the average of 424. Amazingly,
incredible.
He did that. I'm Dan McLaughlin. This is Derek Gould. Rogers Hornsby.
Amazing. Probably a player who, for the modern generation, the best way to put it is he was the first Albert Pujols the team had. You know, all the things that Albert Pujols did as a first baseman, third base, left field, all that. What Albert Pujols did in his first decade with the Cardinals, Roger Hornsby did all of that before him.
We probably don't talk about it enough, do we? Maybe because we're just so far removed from it, I guess.
Yeah, probably not. I mean, one of the best right-handed hitters the game has ever seen, a guy who had a decade triple crown like Albert Pujols, in the sense that he, for an entire decade, led the National League in average home runs and RBIs.
So amazing.
Had the decade triple crown. I think, you know, a remarkable player, probably because he didn't spend all of his career with the Cardinals, maybe.
Right.
I think also, you know, there's a logo retired for him, not a number that's retired for him. So some of these things that are very modern in our sensibility, like, oh, we see a number retired, we think of that player and that number. Whereas you see a logo out there, you don't think, well, that logo belongs to a player. You think more a logo belongs to a team. So, you know, but I do think that, you know, true to Cardinals history, there's probably not a Cardinals fan that doesn't know there's an S on the end of Rogers, right? I mean, that's something that you probably learn by the time you graduate, you know, elementary school or move on from elementary school, that Rogers has an S on the end of it. But but his feats offensively were remarkable, overshadowed in his era by a guy named Babe Ruth, but no less of a remarkable right-handed hitter than the game has ever seen.
Bob Gibson in 1.12.
Yeah, the 50th anniversary of it was not too long ago, right? And, you know, the number that redefined the game, right, that changed the rules.
Did you talk to Bob about it?
I did. I talked to Bob about it in the scope of a larger interview where we spent time together at spring training and then again at Busch Stadium briefly for different topics on it. You know, he's very good at talking to Commish, Rick Hummel at the Post Dispatch, about the ins and outs of that number.
I did a long interview with him. It's on the website.
Yeah.
And it's interesting. It's not that he doesn't want to talk about it, but he says many people forget that year how many other pitchers had great numbers, and mine just happened to be the best.
He in talking with him, one of the things that he brought up was how could have been, I want to make sure I get this right, and he may have shared this sentiment with you as well, that he could have had a better season and had a higher ERA. And his point is that there were times where, and he makes a joke about it, right? Like, you know, I couldn't give up, I had to give up zero runs because we were only going to score one run, and that was the only way I could win. And he had so many games in there where he gave up one run and they would lose. So I think his point was that there were times where that season would have looked different given on the run support, or had he, you know, done some things in the games he lost.
Yeah.
And that the ERA might have been a bit higher, but he would have had a better season overall, if that makes sense. Though
no
it's
question.
Hard to imagine anyone being more dominant. I mean, we haven't seen a pitcher be that dominant. I know that was the year of the pitcher. You know, in which Pedro Martinez had a really strong year that stood out compared to all of his peers. But I still think, like, to the point that Gibson was making, that a lot of guys had low ERA, he still had to do it. You know, yeah, there was a lot of pitching performances that year, and yes, there were a lot of big numbers as far as pitchers go that year, but he still had to stand above the group in that year. And I think that's fitting in a way. You know, in a year when pitching was good all around, he was still elite. And to me, that puts his whole career in context.
Yeah.
At a time when pitching was good and the game was bending towards a pitching direction, it was him that helped change the rules, and it was still him that stood head and shoulders above his peers.
Steve Carlton's 19. So he strikes out 19 in a game in September 15th of 1969.
Right. So another guy, you know, remarkably not linked to the Cardinals. And I wonder why. Like, I don't. I think he's had more, though.
I'll disagree with you to a point. I think he's gotten more recognition now than he did before. And I say that because, for instance, I've brought him back for a couple of events to talk to fans in St. Louis, which he had not done before. I'll pull back the curtain here a little bit. Jim Hayes went to get him on the reunion teams that we've had. He's here. He's back in town. And yep. Tim McCarver was with me. And this is a unique story. Jim went to go get him to put him on the air with us. And he says to Jim, he says, you know, I don't do these things. And he said, I know. And he said, it sounds like I'm giving myself a pat on the back, but he said, who's it with? He said, it'll be with Dan and Tim. And he said, that's the only two guys I'll go on the air with.
Oh, it makes sense.
And, yeah. You know, because he's got a comfort level with us. We've been out to dinner with him. Tim and Steve obviously are very close.
Right.
But he trusts me, too, and I'm proud of that. And so to have him back, I want him back in the family. I think it's important, and I say that about Keith Hernandez as well. You know, we don't link him as much to the Cardinals and great numbers that he had in 79, winning the MVP and maybe the best defensive first baseman of all time. But, you know, back to the 19 strikeouts that you wrote about and then how he haunted the Cardinals once he was traded away.
Yeah.
It's really good stuff.
Oh, my gosh. He was so successful against the Cardinals, not just in the sense of what could have happened had he stuck around, you know, had he not had the contract issue and forced his way out. But, you know, how good could that – I mean, would you have been talking about – a dynasty, probably, right? I mean, a left-right combo
Jerry
that would
Royce
have carried
too.
Forever. You wouldn't have had the dead zone of the 70s for the Cardinals. You probably would have had more years of contention there. And then, of course, he's one of the reasons behind the elevation of a rival to success in that era. So,
do you know also in that story, which has been talked about and written about, the difference in money, that he was walking down to accept in the hallway the deal?
So
and he had not said that publicly, but he told me that he said, I finally had come to the conclusion I'll agree to the deal with the Bush family. And he was walking down the hallway and they had made the trade and that was it. It's hard to if you're a Cardinal fan, that's hard to swallow.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there are moments like that, you know, throughout Cardinal history, the a what if of Cardinal history would be fascinating. You know?
Oh, man.
A lot of those where, like, what if this guy had remained? What if, you know, what if this manager had remained? What if, you know, what if this player had come at a different time? Or what if they had kept Steve Carlton?
So all this stuff is, and we're going to wrap it up here, in the book. And the book is 100 Things Cardinals Fans Should Know and Do Before They Die, written by Derek Gould. To give you an idea, goes through the numbers, the Hall of Famers, Ricky Ankiel's second act, meet Fred Bird, Whitey Herzog, Glenn Brummer stealing, Tom Alston, the first African-American player that played for the Cardinals, Frankie Frisch.
Cool story there about how he's introduced.
Yes. I mean, you've really done some great digging on this. The train rescue of 1911. I mean, it goes on and on and on. You're to be congratulated on the book. I love it. I use it all the time. I read it all the time. It's enjoyable.
And if you have the previous copies like you have, and I'm flattered by how dog-eared your copy is, you know,
I read it. I do read a lot.
No, I appreciate it. I mean, I hope it could be a resource manual for some folks. The new one has obviously the modern stuff in there. You know, like a whole chapter on Yadier Molina, a whole chapter on Adam Wainwright, a whole chapter exploring the most recent manager and then the current manager and their backgrounds and how and what they share and
how about David Freeze
and how different they are. That was actually, yeah, I expanded on the David Freeze, but I didn't just do modern stuff.
Yeah.
I also went back and added
With Red.
Right. I also went back with there, but I also went way back and I added some stuff about the 1880s and perhaps a championship that happened that the Cardinals don't claim and the internal wrestling match that they're going through, trying to figure out where that fits in their history and whether or not it should be a pennant that flies above Bush.
Where can fans get the book?
So fans can get the book, obviously, on Amazon or anywhere they get their books. It's also carried at many local bookstores, Barnes & Noble, at Left Bank Books. I signed several copies of it. There is also copies at, you know, just a lot of the smaller bookstores, independent bookstores.
Awesome. Thanks, Derek, so much.
Thank you, Dan. Thanks for having me.
100 Things Cardinals Fans Should Know and Do Before They Die, written by Derek Gould. This is Inside Cardinals Nation. Thanks for being with us. I'm Dan McLaughlin. And again, the book, 100 Things Cardinals Fans Should Know and Do Before They Die, written by Derek Gould.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.